This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. A few years ago, one of our guests suggested as the climate destabilized, the world economy could go down with it. With one weather disaster following another, it costs more trying to recover than a country can produce or tax its citizens. Eventually, decades away, there would be no money for recovery. Governments would become incapable and bankrupt. That time is now. After a year of record snowstorms, record drought and fires, record tornadoes, remember all those? And now a hurricane of the century, the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is broke. Already, municipal and state governments were teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. America is going broke. Lurking behind, driving energy and extreme rainfall into the clouds, while drying a quarter of the U.S. nation into worse than Dust Bowl times, the carbon engine of climate change continues to power up. Next week, we'll do our official kickoff for the fall season of EcoShock. I've got a lineup of guests with gusto and guts. This week is really for our dedicated fans and anyone else who will listen. We have a new speech by the world's most influential climate scientist. He works with European heads of state. He receives delegations from China. Recently, he advised the White House. This is a powerful mind at the vortex of the most recent and urgent scientific research into the new climate you and I are making. For all the institutions and panels he heads, most North Americans have never heard his name, unless they subscribe to a YouTube Uber conspiracy channel, perhaps, where he is villainized. Hans Joachim Schellenhuber, known as John to his English-speaking friends. That's the name, Schellenhuber. Among other things, he was research director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research in Britain, an awe-inspiring position. Now he is director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, also known as PIC, and on the side, a chair for theoretical physics at the University of Potsdam, Germany. In September 2009, John Schellenhuber was a presenter at the first conference convened to consider the worst. A world where temperature rises beyond our current ecology. A world without ice, anywhere. It was called 4 Degrees and Beyond at Oxford University. In July 2011, Schellenhuber gave two keynote speeches for the second such conference, this time in Melbourne, Australia. His public speech is available with video on the net at 4degrees2011.com.au. 4degrees2011.com.au. Make sure you listen or see that speech. There is a lot of important information you have not heard, partly because it is so new. Some of it you will not hear on this program either, because I want you to hear the speech he gave to the university conference audience. It is raw and disturbing. I'm almost hesitant to pass it on. We all need to know where we are going when we set out for a drive, flick a switch, use the buried fossil power from the distant past. From the 4 Degrees or More conference in Australia, courtesy of the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute and other sponsors, both public and private, this keynote address for experts has been lightly edited for radio time. The title, Strange Encounters Behind the 2 Degrees Firewall. Here is Professor Hans Joachim Schellenhuber.
Trying to protect the climate, trying to make your domestic national contribution to saving the planet must not mean necessarily that we will be all deindustrialized and poverty-stricken and the end of the world will coming soon, quite to the contrary. Anyway, I'll talk about that later. So let me start here. Strange encounters behind the 2 degrees fireball. Why so? Of course we can talk about 4 degrees and 5 degrees and 6 degrees, but you know that there is an international agreement, and actually this is a miracle in its own, confirmed in Cancun during the latest climate conference, that we have a quantitative climate protection target. If you go back to the UN Convention on Climate Change, which was sealed in 1992 in Rio, this was a very vague statement. Let's avoid somehow dangerous climatic change, whatever that means. That is worth almost nothing, and the scientific community, together with all the committed people in business, in civil society, and in policy making have struggled for almost 20 years in order to get a quantitative target established. Now, 2 degrees does not mean below 2 degrees everything is fine and beyond that it's the end of the world. It's not a hard scientific target, but it is one which is a fairly reasonable compromise between feasibility and desirability, as I will outline later on. So, what can we expect to happen behind that firewall? It is a firewall because, in a sense, you sacrifice some space, which is on our side of the firewall. It would be much better, in particular for the Pacific Islands, to have no global warming at all, if we could achieve that. Because 2 degrees in the long run means the vanishing of many island communities. So the Maldives are lost if we keep to the 2 degrees target. That is a very bitter truth. But if we would go beyond that, if we would not have even that firewall, we might even risk the end of a higher form of civilization on this planet. So that's the rationale of a firewall. What is going to happen behind that wall? Okay, let me start, and first let me review what I call the current past of climate change. And when you talk about that, it's always very important to go to decadal averages. And this is a very nice plot produced by Jim Hansen's group at Columbia University, which shows you simply in the last 4 decades, over the last 4 decades, how the planet has warmed up as compared to average regional temperatures. So you have a geographically explicit plot here, and it's called the temperature anomaly. And you see it means more or less that over the 4 decades, the planet has warmed up by just 0.5 degrees. Now, people often make jokes about it and say, well, difference between day and night or flying to Brisbane or whatever is much, much bigger. But when I, in general, respond by telling them, but if you think of your body temperature and you would have 2 degrees warming, that means you have fever, or 4 degrees means you are dead. So we're talking about the body temperature of our planet, actually, which is a sort of self-controlled feedback system. And if you disturb that in such a dramatic way, even half a degree makes a huge difference. It means the planet, even within these 4 decades, has sort of developed a very slight form of fever already. But the other interesting thing is the regional differences. So you can spot Australia here, but even more interesting are the things I'm going to talk about also later is the West Antarctic Peninsula and Greenland. So if you focus on Greenland, you see no anomaly or even a cooler than average situation in the 1970s. Nothing happened in the 1980s. But here, over the last decade, Greenland has warmed up tremendously. Well, with the West Antarctic Peninsula, you see it was already developing an anomaly in the 1970s, and that has sort of continued, and now it's one of the, compared to average, sort of fastest warming up regions in the world, with a number of impacts to be expected. Now, when it comes to global mean temperature, people often say warming is sort of accelerating at the global level. That is not true. It is just within the range of IPCC prediction. So you have this wobbly line, so the black curve is the observation, goes up and down. It is coupled to El Niño Zafa oscillation and many other things. Not so much the solar variations. They are in the range of 0.1 degree centigrade, more or less. So even if the sun is not active over the next decade, it doesn't play a big role in the climate. And you see it's going up and down. These are various data sets. But more or less in 2010, we are on track, more or less, with the predictions of the IPCC. The most interesting thing probably is not on this slide, that not only was 2010 more or less the warmest year on record, it was also the wettest year on record. Oh, that's an interesting thing. Because according to very fundamental physics, Clausius-Clapeyron equation or things like that, we should have, of course, a strengthening of the global hydrological cycle when we're warming up this planet. The problem is that the precipitation will not come in a uniform way all over the planet, but the more arid regions will become even more arid in the future, and the wetter regions will become even more wet, simply because we have a cell structure on this planet, and the cell structure, the Hadley cell, feral cell, the polar cell, gets strengthened. The circulation is getting strengthened in general, and that means the precipitation injustice on this planet will be increased. Now, here is a trend which is accelerating clearly, that is Arctic sea ice extent. So you see various numbers here. So you have average here, you have the last years. Actually, 2011 was on a record course here. Now it seems that the ice is regrowing a little bit faster. Now, the interesting thing, it was said, but I was trained in theoretical physics and mathematics, so there was an interesting paper in Physics Today very recently asking if we have this trend of acceleration of sea level, sea ice reduction. People tried to calculate it, what it really needs to reduce the sea ice cover in the Arctic, and the big puzzle is why it didn't melt much faster. Because if you have just 1 watt per square meter perturbation, when it should melt like this, but with reorientation of ocean currents and so on, and warmer sea water, in some places where there was a perturbation of up to 10 watts per square meter. So the ice is still there. That is amazing, but it's not a very comforting insight, actually. So we could see much more surprises in this context. And then, of course, very important when we talk about sea level rise, the combined contribution of Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet. And here you clearly see, again, a wobbly line, but a trend towards deglaciation. And it means, in the end, that by the mid-century, there will be at least a contribution to global sea level of 15 centimeters by the ice sheet. Now, this is not covered by the last IPCC report, and I'm afraid that it will not be covered either by the next IPCC report. We tried to create various research projects in order to create evidence which goes into the fifth assessment report. But you know, the IPCC, although people may say differently here in Australia, I understand you have a very vital skeptics community here. The IPCC is an extremely conservative network of scholars, actually. And the last projection on sea level rise was, you know, maybe 25 centimeters or something by the end of the century. But there was a little footnote. The small print said the contribution of the big ice sheets is not considered at all. Why? Not because something will not happen, but simply the scientific evidence seemed not to be strong enough to put any bounds on it. It seems now that we are doing much better, but I'm still skeptical in a different way, that the IPCC will include all the latest evidence on the ice sheet contribution.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are hearing a keynote address mainly to scientists and experts in Australia. It was in July with the same disturbing assessment John Schellenhuber has given directly to many heads of government.
And here, CO2 emissions. If you feel that there is any relationship between carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere and global warming, this is very bad news, because the financial crisis created a dip in global emissions, but we are back on track. And actually, if you look at the latest International Energy Agency predictions on industry-related emissions. There will be a record increase of CO2 emissions of 5% or something. So we are going over the top, really, in this context. Anyway, so that is the past future, the last IPCC report I mentioned already. So this is the famous fan of various scenarios, A1, B2, and so on, which would produce different climate futures, and in particular important because this is more or less business as usual, an additional warming by the end of the century of 2 or 3 degrees, on top of the 0.7, 0.8 we have already experienced since 1900. But this is the past future. There is a current future as well. Now, if you assume, and in particular, if you assume in spite of the carbon tax, which was announced, I guess, 2 days ago here in Australia, I think it's a good working hypothesis to assume that the world is not going to end by the year 2100. I think that's true. And that was a joke again, just for your information. So, if the world is not going to end by 2100, it would be fairly appropriate to look beyond that data. And that's what you get. Now, that's a fairly complicated thing. Now, I owe a number of inputs to my colleague Malte Meinshausen, who I guess is here. Malte, are you here? Aha. Welcome to Australia. So, he has provided a lot of very interesting analysis. I picked this one called the representative concentration pathway. So a new set of scenarios. What is going to happen regarding emissions? And this is the small panel here. You see fossil CO2 emissions till the year 2300. That's very important, actually. And you have a number of scenarios. This is the worst-case scenario, but all of these scenarios are self-consistent, if you like. So these are not fairy tales, but consistent narratives of the future, of the industrial future, so to speak. And there's a best-case scenario, the blue one here, and I come back to that later. You see, these are the corresponding concentrations in the atmosphere. So with the RCP 8.5, you're going towards 2,000 ppm in the atmosphere, that is six times or so on the pre-industrial level, while with the best of all worlds regarding emission reductions, you would peak somewhere near 420 or so, something, or 450. Now, the interesting thing is now, what would it mean in terms of temperature? And that's why it's so important to go beyond 2,100. The climate system is a very slow system reacting in a highly nonlinear way. So if we would have something like 2 degrees warming by the year 2050, it would stay on the high-end scenario. You see, in 2100, yes, maybe 4 degrees warming above pre-industrial. That's the theme of the conference. But then you would go further than that, and it would be maybe 7.5 or 8 degrees in the year 2300. By the way, sea level will rise, of course, in parallel with that. So a warming of 2 degrees by 2100 may mean 7 meter sea level or 8 meter sea level rise in the year 2500 or something. It's a highly inert system. Now, with the best of all worlds in terms of climate protection, you would more or less scratch the 2 degrees line and then slowly, very, very slowly settle back to milder temperatures. But it would still take millennia to approach anything near the pre-industrial level. So it means the planet has been changed for good, more or less, so for the next 50,000 years, when the next ice age is due, already by human action. But it makes a huge difference whether we sit on the blue fan or the red fan. The difference is human civilization, if you like. So how can we close this gap? Now, going back, actually, now, since you have seen the temperature impact, let's revisit the best-case scenario, the blue one. Now, that tells you Emissions of CO2 will peak around 2020, dramatically decline and reach the zero line around the middle of the century, and then turn negative for the rest of the century. Do I have to repeat this? Peak by 2020, decline steeply, and go negative. That means we will suck up carbon from the atmosphere with various techniques. Now, if you tell this inconvenient truth to policymakers, even if we sit in Germany or in the UK, their eyes are glazing over, as you can imagine, because it simply means we are already in a situation with the most dramatic of all climate protection scenarios. We can hold the 2 degrees line, which at the same time has been adopted by 194 nations. We have a new nation since last Sunday, Southern Sudan. They will rush to adopt the 2 degrees target, I'm pretty sure, although they don't know at all what it means. So we have this complete discrepancy, the psychologists would call it cognitive dissonance, between the target, which is now more or less a universal target, and the strategy we need in order to come near that. And again, let me remind you, it is the blue line which we have to consider. Now, compared to that, I will not mingle into Australian affairs, but if you just contrast the carbon tax, whatever it's called, with this epochal sort of complete sea change type transformation of the emission system, and you see we still have a long way to go. 2 degrees. Why 2 degrees? This is the burning embers diagram, as the late Steve Schneider called it. Actually, I invented this thing in the third assessment report when we did the synthesis chapter of the third assessment report working group on impacts and adaptation back in 2000, together with Rick Lehmans from Wageningen University, because we wanted to provide a semi-quantitative assessment of what it means if we go up the temperature line. So we used color coding, simply saying if you are in the white range, you could also pick green, of course. You are more or less okay. If you are in the yellow range, be careful. If you are entering the red zone, you are going to have big problems. And this was specified along 5 reasons for concern. Again, at that time, the third assessment report, it was completely politically incorrect to talk about dangerous climate change. Later on, I was the co-organizer of the Exeter Conference on Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change when we created this book with Cambridge University Press, came out in 2005, Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change. By that time, it was allowed to talk about dangerous, but it was just reason for concern. Now, if you do this, you see that if you go to ecosystems like coral reefs, if an additional 1 degree warming is very devastating, and I'm sure the evidence will be provided again here at this conference. Now, when it comes to the really big hits, like what we call tipping points events, the collapse of the Greenland ice sheet, destabilization of the Indian summer monsoon, and so on, and we probably have some leeway. Now, the 2 degrees line is sitting here. It's, in a sense, a very bad compromise. It's a compromise with nature. It just tells you, along certain dimensions of concern or danger, 2 degrees is already too much. But we have a certain hope, if you go to the right-hand column, we have a certain degree of hope, at least, that we can avoid the big hits. Namely, nonlinear events in the Earth system, which are largely irreversible, large-scale, continental-scale, cannot be undone, more or less. Once you melt down the Greenland ice sheet, as I said, you have to wait at least 50,000 years in order to reproduce it. That is when the next ice age is due, according to the Milankovitch cycles. So that is the compromise with nature. I wanted to show you this. Malte Meinthausen actually has provided that together with Parrett and other colleagues. I think that's a fascinating study. I showed some of his slides at the Vatican recently, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which is having some 20 Nobel laureates, consists of 80 members only. So we met at the Vatican City, which was quite interesting, in particular because we had private access to Michelangelo's frescoes in the Sistine Chapel. That was probably the best conference I ever had. But apart from that, we produced a declaration for the Pope, and he's speaking for 1.5 billion people, so it's okay. This was about the injustice of sea level rise. That's really an extremely important point. Because if you pick any scenario, now here a scenario, one of these scenarios I showed, simply means on average you have about a meter sea level rise by 2100, but it's more or less the central value we can expect, a meter of sea level rise all over the globe. But the funny thing is, and the very vicious thing is, but the sea level rise will be distributed in a highly inhomogeneous way across the planet. If you go along all the coastlines of the continents. Now, in particular, if a lot of that comes from Greenland, now, elementary physics. If Greenland is losing mass, that means its gravitational pull for seawater will be diminished. If you lose mass, you cannot attract. This is also true for human behavior, sometimes. Sometimes it's the other way around. This is not the theme of the conference, I know. But the gravitational pull will be diminished, and that means around Greenland, sea level may even drop, in particular for the northeastern part of the American continent. While there will be a sort of ridge of water, in particular in the Pacific, around the equator, and the Pacific Islands again, who haven't done anything in order to contribute to global warming, will again get the brunt of it, will get all the water which is released from Greenland, for example. By those who are most responsible for that, Northern Europe, Northern America, and so on, will be spared sea level rise, at least for a while. So you see, nature can be extremely unfair if humanity is sort of provoking that injustice. Okay, same is true for a shift of biomes, so I'm sure you can do this for Australia. The interesting thing here simply is if you take various scenarios from the Max Planck Institute or for the Hadley Center, you get very different, very similar shifts in ecosystem behavior, very different shifts in biomes, so in particular forest and woodland decline. That is the sort of brownish color here in the United States here. So these are dramatic ecological shifts. And in particular, they come with dramatic changes in ecosystem services. Nobody has really calculated the costs of it so far, but I'm sure it's in the trillions.
You are listening to a keynote speech by Professor John Schellenhuber, director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. This recording comes from the 4 Degrees or More conference in Melbourne, Australia, held July 12th to 14th, 2011. Find all the lectures free at 4degrees2011.com.au. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.